Welcome to Episode 2 of Rise, an Eastern Standard series about the struggles and challenges left in Eastern Kentucky by the powerful and devastating flash flood of July 28, 2022.
The 2021 flood, folks talked about it as being a once-in-a-lifetime event. They've never seen anything like this. Places that had never flooded. And then this one comes along and it's even more severe. There are a lot of the houses that, you know, were flooded in Breathitt County in 2021 had 3 or 4 foot more water this time.
Scott McReynolds of the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard. The organization is among those leading the effort to rebuild. Another, located in Whitesburg and led by Seth Long, is Housing Oriented Ministries Established for Service, or Homes, Inc.
So much has been done, but there's so much to do yet. It's really incomprehensible.
The massive force of so much floodwater swept up homes, vehicles, belongings, people. 44 died. Many were left homeless. It took state officials only a few hours to recognize that the damages would far exceed the threshold required to request a presidential declaration. 13 counties were declared disaster areas, 4 in particular, Breathitt, Knott, Perry, and Letcher, where Seth Long is working to rebuild.
That's one of the frustrating part of the recovery is the communications between agencies. It's really hard to get good numbers that you can, you know, plan on. And it shouldn't be that way, but it's the way that it is. This is just anecdotally, you know, I've been working with homes since 1991. I've been doing this a long, long time. And just from experience, I think that 25% of our houses in Letcher County have been impacted in a way that have displaced families from their homes. Some of those families will go back to those homes, but many won't.
A conservative estimate puts the number of homes destroyed or severely damaged at just over 1,600 across the 13 counties that were declared disaster areas. But that estimate accounts only for those who filed applications for help from FEMA. Many others did not.
When you go to FEMA to apply for assistance, you've got to have all kinds of documents with you. Well, if your house has been washed down the river, pretty hard to come up with all that documentation.
Tom Carew, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Kentucky State Director for Rural Development.
That's part of the challenge for individual families and households, as well as for FEMA, is to trying to get the information that FEMA needs so they can provide assistance, but at the same time working with the families to see if they can come up with that documentation. So it is a catch-22.
It's been almost 6 months since the flood. Life, already a daily struggle for so many in the region, has gone on. Katie Myers with Apple Shop's WMMT in Whitesburg has been out talking with people.
On the outside, it looks like an ordinary shed. Inside, neighbors catch up while they look through piles of toiletries, diapers, and toys.
There are some people getting in their homes, and a lot of them need supplies.
There's a makeshift office where Donna Rourke works. She lives next door, and she's kept the shed open because the needs keep coming, keep changing, as people rebuild.
And every day, people bring stuff in. The people, not the officials, not anybody else. It's just the people.
Rourke calls it the people's building. There's federal and state money committed to the region, but it can be confusing and difficult to navigate getting money in hand. Rourke doesn't have a lot of faith in these institutions. What she sees most is regular people stretching their own resources to help out.
All the money that was donated and appropriated for the people, they haven't seen it.
That's life in Eastern Kentucky right now. A limbo, a holding pattern. Even for those who still have their houses, the cold brings urgency. The money they cobbled together can't cover everything.
It's being smooshed and everybody's like on top of everybody.
Rosa Foss came to the People's Building from her temporary state camper on Car Fork Lake. She lives there with her husband and 2 daughters. She needed to stretch her legs a little.
Mom, are we able to come for charity?
No.
And she brought her youngest, Molly, with her.
It was okay during the summertime because they would get out and ride their bikes and stuff. But now that they're in the house, they're right together.
Molly is outgoing and sweet. She runs around the shed, not always staying out of trouble. But when they're alone, Foss says she gets sad.
She was telling me this morning she just wants to go back home.
About 25 minutes drive away, Janice's niece lives on a steep hill above a gully with a creek running through it. Her dad, brother, and husband are all buried there next to each other, and someday she will be too. After the flood, the hill began to give. She keeps a nervous watch on it through the pouring rain.
Because once the ground freezes and it thaws back out, it's just going to cause it to sink more.
She's not worried about the house falling off the hill. It's the graves.
I don't even know if I'm going to have enough money to even fix all this, to be honest. It needs to be fixed, I do know that, because the dead's resting in peace.
She finally found contractors after 5 months, but they can't come quick enough.
This whole ordeal's been stress.
Tommy Newhouse lives in Topmost, in Knott County. It's one of the hardest hit communities, and it's still pretty wrecked. The flood broke the bridge that connects his house to the main road.
Dealing with FEMA has been nothing but stress.
Newhouse is on disability. Outside of his family home, he doesn't have a lot of money or assets. He felt powerless this fall, spending hours on hold with every authority he could think of.
They didn't care you was in a disaster. They didn't care that your world got turned upside down. It was like, you ain't got the paperwork, who cares?
After numerous FEMA appeals, he finally found someone to fix the bridge. It's a slow but significant step forward.
You! I said you! You're a lot of trouble.
In the Millstone Missionary Baptist Church, the church ladies cooked Christmas dinner. Ham, green beans, enough mashed potatoes to feed a mob. Billy June Richardson, the pastor's daughter, came to help. It was the church's first Christmas dinner since before COVID.
And they're cooking and we'll have people come in from everywhere with food and it'll be a nice night.
Most days, she drives around Millstone trying to connect people with resources.
I get calls. Can you send me an electrician? Can you send me a plumber? Can you send me some help? So,
the holiday season wasn't all cheer. Further extreme weather came in the form of a severe Christmas weekend cold snap, which froze water lines and burst pipes all over eastern Kentucky. Richardson fielded calls for help from flood survivors. Pipes burst in trailers and people were cold. She says, folks are tired of being resilient. And it's feeling like, as usual, it's the neighbors who are going to come through in the end. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Katie Myers.
And so now, floodplain residents are left to decide, do we stay or do we go? And this is where it gets complicated. Emotional. The Housing Development Alliance's Mindy Miller.
Nobody ever thought creek water would get up 30 feet or whatever. But when that happened, that's the first time I saw defeat in a lot of people's faces.
Stephanie Roby, Assistant Director of Administration at the State Division of Emergency Management, talking with WEKU's Stan Ingold.
They love being on the creek or the tributary or, you know, they love being there. And it's a lifestyle. And they are hesitant to leave that behind. But also, you know, there have been a lot of lives lost and a lot of close calls, and people are having to make some difficult decisions.
I think that there will be people who move.
Jerry Roll, Executive Director of the Hazard-Based Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky.
Many families are willing to move. They barely got out of their homes with their children. They barely got out with their lives. It's a rude awakening, and I think people are willing to maybe move away from their home place if they can stay in their home community, which is this region of southeastern Kentucky.
Seth Long of Homes Inc. experienced it when he introduced one couple to their new home.
The owners just, you know, grabbed my hand and said, an elderly couple that said, you know, we thought that we were going to have to leave this part of the country, and this is where their family is, this is where their life was. And they said, we had no idea that homes could be of assistance to us, and we just so deeply appreciate everything that we've done for them, because they were really at a loss. And I really have a lot of respect for, you know, somebody at that age, at that position in life, thinking about what do we do now. You know, that motivates us to do the hard work when we see results like that.
But as Seth Long acknowledged, there are concerns about losing population.
The last census that came out, Letcher County was the quickest declining county in the state of Kentucky. And when this is on top of it, you know, of course, it's on everybody's mind.
such as Laura Thomas, mayor of Jackson in Breathitt County.
So many have left, and that is heartbreaking because we have a shortage of housing. We had a shortage prior to the flood, and once people were displaced from their homes, there was nowhere to put them.
This latest pressure to leave the region just continues a long-running trend. I talked about that with Matthew Ruther at the State Data Center based at the University of Louisville. I've seen projections from the data center that look at Letcher, not county, losing something like up to 43% of their population over 30 years. Is that correct?
That is correct. We do these projections every couple of years based on the most current data that we have. And so what we've seen in some of these counties, Letcher, not Pike County, is that deaths have been outnumbering births for some time now. So you have a natural decline based on that. And you also have out-migration. And so together, these two things result in these sort of enormous population losses over time.
Beyond the obvious humanitarian reasons to make housing a top priority of recovery, Jim King, president and CEO of the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises, FAHI, offers another.
Can't have the luxury of saying, well, what we just need are more jobs. Well, okay, jobs have to have places to live. You know, people have to go home at night.
And that concern is reinforced by one who has been on the scene of major natural disasters since Hurricane Katrina slammed New Orleans. J.R. Sanderson is Senior Government Advisor for the National Disaster Recovery and Resilience Organization, SBP.
If a community doesn't recover, people just get up and leave. And when people get up and leave, you lose your tax base. And when you lose your tax base, now all of a sudden I don't have money for schools, for fire departments, for sidewalks or anything, right? I've lost my tax base. And we've seen that happen across America, where we've simply had a disaster that was so traumatic that people just abandoned their property and moved somewhere else.
According to the many we have spoken with for this series, there is agreement that housing is priority one, and for a variety of reasons, but one in particular.
The whole intent of the Hazard Mitigation Acquisition Program is to get people out of harm's way.
Stephanie Roby with State Emergency Management talking with WEKU's Stan Ingold.
What we have done in this particular event is that, you know, we've met one-on-one with people who have been impacted and are considering going to a safer location. And they have, in essence, signed up. They've given us notice that they're interested.
How are the prices or the value of the property determined for the purchase of the buyout?
There are a number of factors that come into play. The first and foremost would be the PVA records. An appraiser is hired who has a good understanding of the local area. And so, you know, if the appraisal comes in low or the PVA records come in low, there is a concerted effort made to maximize whatever that value determination is going to be.
FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, provides 75% of the funds required to buy out a home at its assessed value. The local government has to come up with the rest.
There are a lot of other expenses associated with this process other than just the cost of the property.
Stephanie Roby.
It's just like any major mortgage activity that anyone would go through. You have to have a title search. You have to have the appraisal. You have to have the closing. If there was an existing mortgage on the property, that has to be taken care of before disbursement to the homeowner. You know, there are a lot of pieces and parts.
And you may be surprised to learn what becomes of the property once the buyout is completed.
The property, it becomes the property of the applicant, be it a city or a county, and they are required to remove all structures off of the property and return it to green space. And you cannot construct anything on the property except for perhaps a pavilion where people could have a picnic. And you cannot do that unless you get express permission from FEMA.
It's a long process. Whitney Bailey is a staff attorney at AppleRed, the Appalachian Research and Defense Fund of Kentucky. Chris Begley sat down with her at the AppleRed office in Prestonsburg.
One of the most recent surprising need I found or heard about are the people who have had to get a credit card. They took pride in not having any debt, but then the flood happened and they are stuck in the cycle of waiting for FEMA assistance or Red Cross assistance, whatever the case may be. And they had to take out a credit card, and then they also might have to take out, you know, payday loans, different types of credit avenues, because they need that financial help now. They can't afford to pay for groceries on their fixed incomes as it is because of the recent increase in prices.
For many, pulling up deep roots is not an option. Scott McReynolds, head of the Housing Development Alliance.
There are, of course, people who, you know, it's family land, it's generational land. They're going to go right back there no matter what. You know, in those cases, you hope that we can, you know, help folks can get their home elevated enough so that if it does flood again, at least it doesn't get in the house.
Property's been passed down via airship from, you know, one generation to the next.
Tom Carew with the USDA. He's based in Moorhead.
You know, at USDA, we've got some leeway around that, but, you know, working with the family and their attorney, we can probably come up with some sort of a solution that shows that they've owned the property. But that's a general response. May not work for every case, because if there are lots of heirs in your generation and you're the one heir that's living on the property, so then that creates another set of problems in terms of how do you divide the property up so that you own your share.
On the other hand, notes the Housing Development Alliance's Scott McReynolds,
I have had conversations with a lot of people who would be willing to leave land if they felt like they had another viable option.
Where can they go?
Jeremy Slinker is director of the Kentucky Division of Emergency Management.
What was safe last year may or may not be now. That's being determined. But we all know people that were not in the floodplain and were flooded.
Statewide, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, Kentucky had a shortage of some 79,000 homes for low-income households, and that number was compiled before the most recent tornadoes in the West and flooding in the East. So what are we talking about here in terms of dollars? How much funding will it take to replace these destroyed or severely damaged homes? Fahy's Jim King.
Our operating number right now, in addition to the financing we would normally bring to, say, a mortgage market or a commercial real estate market, yeah, just under $300 million.
Some state legislators are floating a three-year plan that would allocate half of that, $150 million, to housing in eastern Kentucky.
It is our hope the legislature will take a serious look at putting some funds together for some of these efforts in this legislative session. And I think it's needed, I think, not just for the flood recovery, but even to some extent for some of the lack of investment that has been made in affordable housing over the last several decades.
A proposal being advanced by a coalition of nonprofit housing groups called AHART for the Affordable Housing Emergency Action Recovery Trust calls on the current General Assembly to fund support for replacing and repairing housing damaged by natural disasters such as the July flood.
Housing is the biggest crisis that we have right now.
Seth Long of Homes, Inc.
This is over a 13-county area with thousands of houses that are lost. Many of these people that were living in the houses have a marginal income, and there are no options.
You'll hear this from Jackson's Mayor Thomas.
Housing is an immediate need.
You'll hear it from Jerry Roll at the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky.
The legislature is going to have to make sure that there is funding for housing in this upcoming session.
You will hear it from those who have lost everything, people like Karen Mosley in Knott County.
You can't find any place to rent. There's nothing here, and I'm sure there's not much in Whitesburg, or I don't know about Floyd County, but there's nothing here.
And Bobby McIntosh in Jackson.
I just want people to know that we still need help.
The Omnibus Government Spending Bill, passed by Congress in December, allocated federal dollars. Mountain Eagle reporter Sam Adams obtained from the office of Senator Mitch McConnell a list of how that funding breaks down.
There's $60 million for the USDA's Rural Development, Rural Housing Assistance grants, and that's to make essential repairs and improvements to the homes that were damaged during the disaster, and that's one of the things that's really needed in addition to new homes. There's some money, I think, for building new homes as well, but this money is just for repairing damage.
And what about damaged critical infrastructure?
Out of the $265 million for the water and wastewater disposal programs, $100 million of that is earmarked to this summer's flood damage in Kentucky. So $100 million will go a long way to fixing some of the problems here with sewer systems, which I think the sewer systems were, of course, more damaged than the water systems. They're not designed to take on that much additional water. It really messes up the sewer systems when that happens.
The Mountain Eagle, Sam Adams. Bashir administration officials searching for sites to relocate people who are willing to move have been in negotiations with the owners of High Ground in eastern Kentucky. Mike Harrison is pastor of First Christian Church in Pikeville.
Finding suitable locations to rebuild. I think that would be the greatest challenge because land, well, buildable land in this area is at a premium.
There's a massive problem here. It really defies comprehension, and it is an urgent problem that needs to be addressed.
Seth Long with Homes, Inc. in Whitesburg.
We have lots and lots of land. Much of it's vertical. So the terrain in itself can be difficult. If you have enough money, you can build a house anywhere on the side of a mountain. But to do it affordably, it can be really challenging. Land ownership is a real problem in the area. So a lot of the property is in heirs, where it has lots of ownership from descendants going back. That's a big problem. Finding property that's not in the floodplain and not tied up in heirs is a lot of the battle for us.
The Appalachian Citizen Law Center's Mary Cromer.
We've heard from various federal agencies, especially, well, we've just got to get these people out of the floodplain. We've got to do whatever we can to get people out of the floodplain. It's like, there's nowhere, you know, there's just no available land. So there's that huge kind of justice problem that is just so endemic in Appalachia about land ownership and land property rights issues and how that gets like woven into everything.
The USDA's Tom Carew.
I met with the governor and his staff several times, and my understanding that they've identified some properties in the major flood counties, Perry, Letcher, Knott, and Breathitt. And they're working diligently to, you know, get control of those properties. They have not disclosed where those properties are, who the sellers are, for very legitimate reasons, in the sense that you're negotiating to buy that property and you can't go out and tell everybody, hey, I'm buying this property, because that may affect the price and the willingness of the seller.
The Herald Leader's Bill Estep.
In Whitesburg, local officials there are looking at the potential to create some housing on a former surface mine overlooking Whitesburg. There's a similar effort underway in Knott County. They're looking at creating a housing development, maybe as many as 100 houses, on a reclaimed surface mine on Kentucky 80. There's the same in Perry County. There's a reclaimed, what was a surface mine, just outside the city of Hazard. Some of the local housing advocates are looking at that as a potential for a subdivision. And there's been some development on that land in the past. There's a housing development near the airport in Hazard, which is on reclaimed land, and one in Knott County, some really nice upscale homes, called The Meadow in Knott County. I was there recently and talked with the owner. So there's potential to use that land, but it can be very, very expensive, especially if it's not right on the highway. So, for instance, this place they're looking at in Knott County is right on Kentucky 80, so the access road wouldn't be a problem, and there's already water and electric to that site. So that would be easier to develop and less costly than some others.
Eastern Standard has learned that properties under negotiation include a portion of the nearly 1,400 acres along Route 80, as Bill Estep mentioned, adjacent to the Knott County Sportsplex and owned by Western Pocahontas Properties of West Virginia.
We're going to get that property.
Knott County Attorney Tim Bates.
If it takes time to go through the condemnation process, we're going to get that property. That property has a very, very big need in this county right now. It's perfect for rebuilding out of the flood zone for those that want to do that. I know the governor's office acquired some property by donation from the Adams family on the Perry and Knott line. The problem with that is that property is not developed. There is no road. There is no infrastructure. There is no water, sewer, electricity. It's going to take some time to get that in place, and we still need more property regardless. But this property here, that's already taken place. It's already got water, sewer, electric, and a good roadway.
Talks between public officials and Western Pocahontas on this possible investment of public money have been underway behind closed doors. Multiple well-placed sources familiar with the talks have complained that the company is demanding an exorbitant price for the acreage, far above the assessed value of $2.5 million for the entire 1,390-acre tract. Repeated attempts to invite confirmation and comment from various company representatives have gone unanswered. It's possible that a deal has been struck since this episode of Rise went into production. If that has occurred, the details of this acquisition, as well as any others, will be reported by WEKU News. Flood insurance is an issue. Homes and businesses in high-risk flood areas with government-backed mortgages are required to have coverage.
If you live in an area that is designated a floodplain by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and you have a mortgage, your mortgage lender will require you to carry flood insurance.
Mark Friedlander, Director of Corporate Communications at the Insurance Information Institute based in Florida.
Well, here's the way the insurance industry looks at this. Our recommendation is every homeowner in America should have flood insurance, whether you live in a floodplain or not, because our basic premise is if it rains in your backyard, it could flood your community.
The cost of flood insurance has gotten so expensive that hardly anyone can afford it.
The USDA's Tom Carew.
It needs to be addressed from a congressional standpoint so that if we're going to demand folks have flood insurance, it's got to be reasonably affordable.
The insurance industry spokesman, Mark Friedlander.
Right now, the average national flood insurance program policy in Kentucky is running about $800 a year. That is about 20% less than the U.S. average, which is running nearly $1,000. But still, we understand $800 is too much money for many families in eastern Kentucky that were impacted by the devastating floods last year.
Should Congress act to subsidize participation in the National Flood Insurance Program to make it affordable to low-income homeowners?
Congress has had to bail out the program numerous times because they were running at such a loss. In the last year and a half, they've implemented what's called Flood Insurance Risk Rating 2.0, which is a more actuarially sound approach to flood coverage, meaning they are now rating risk at a similar method to how private insurers rate risk. So they are now charging appropriate rates for flood insurance. We have not heard any proposals of the National Flood Insurance Program getting further subsidies at this point. Until this entity is running at a profitable level, meaning it's not losing millions and millions year after year, we just don't see any other significant changes coming to the program.
The USDA's Tom Carew.
If you talk to the nonprofit organizations that are building houses now, in the region. You talk to the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard or the homes in Whitesburg or Partnership Housing over in Boonville, they'll tell you we're gonna make a pledge that when we When we rebuild for someone, it's going to be out of the 100-year floodplain, unless there's no way around that.
But now, after July 28, that's become a problem. The Housing Development Alliance's Scott McReynolds.
A significant number of the houses that were impacted were not in the floodplain. I mean, we've always avoided building in the floodplain. So now the question is we can't just rely on the floodplain. We have to look at, you know, is this property too close to the creek? We've actually didn't buy a couple of lots that we had intended to buy because we felt like even though they're not in the floodplain, they might flood. And then you also begin to ask do you elevate the houses? Do you strengthen the houses? What can you do to make them more resilient? Particularly in situations where we're, rebuilding for folks to make sure that if something like this happens again, they're not washed away.
A number of homes had been damaged in the flood of 2021 and had just been repaired and made livable again when they were hit once more by the flash flood of last July. What does that mean for the value of the home? Jim King with the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises.
Some housing that should have had flood insurance after one occurrence, if there was any damage from a second flood, those will be left unrepaired. I think in a lot of instances, there's no way to insure it now or to even help people be eligible for certain kinds of assistance. I'm sorry, that paints a dire picture, but I think the long story short of that is that it does decrease value.
While flood insurance is not federally required if you live outside of a designated floodplain, your lender may still require you to have insurance. You're listening to Rise, a special six-part Eastern Standard series.
While the news story's gone, the real story hasn't ended.
Back in a moment.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
Rise is a special six-week series airing weekly on Eastern Standard. Learn about what happened when record-setting flash floods hit southeastern Kentucky at the end of July. Explore what contributed to the disaster, how communities are responding, and what's needed to address the challenges ahead. Hear from those most affected and those working on solutions. WEKU's Tom Martin and a team of reporters take us on a journey as Eastern Kentucky navigates a future made less certain by climate change. To learn more about the series and listen to each episode on demand, visit weku-rise.org. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
That term, floodplains, has been making frequent appearances in the first and now the second episode of Rise. If these extreme weather events are going to become more frequent, and there's every indication that they are, we all need to understand how this works. In episode one, we got a definition from State Water Division Director Carrie Johnson.
The regulatory standard is the 1% annual chance flood, or it's commonly called the 100-year flood. That's a bit of a misnomer, but basically, when it comes to floodplain mapping, we at the Division of Water work very closely with FEMA in identifying those 1% annual chance floods across the Commonwealth. And what an annual 1% annual chance flood is, it's the flood that has a 1% chance of occurring at any given time throughout the year.
FEMA officials have testified to Congress that about 40%, maybe even more, of claims that are made to the National Flood Insurance Program from 2017 to 2019, is the period they're looking at, were for properties that were outside official flood hazard zones or in areas that have not been mapped. Many of the homes that were destroyed or severely damaged in eastern Kentucky were not located in floodplains. So, what does that tell us? Does it signal a new level of urgency behind relocating communities to higher ground, for example?
I think the answer to that is all of the above. You're absolutely right in that the data does show that a vast percentage of flood hazard losses occur outside of mapped or identified special flood hazard zones. But I think it's important to remember that the special flood hazard zones aren't a predictor of the future. They're more or less a communication of the past. But it's also important to realize that even the flood zones that we depict on the flood maps, nature doesn't always follow where those flood hazards go. You know, you can have smaller floods, you can have larger floods, and anywhere in between. That's why we're actually in our collaboration with FEMA, we're working to identify not only better ways to model and map flood hazard zones that uses historic data, but also uses future conditioned data and also assesses areas that may flood outside of, say, a stream corridor. Generally in Kentucky, we associate flooding and flash flooding with our rivers and streams, which Kentucky is a very water-rich state. We have over 90,000 miles of rivers and streams. But there are other areas that flood that we call pluvial flood hazards, mm-hmm. that basically you have a torrential downpour that isn't associated with a stream per se, but there is a depression and you have ponding that floods. So one of the things that we're working on and FEMA has been developing over the past couple of years is something called the Future of Flood Risk Data. Hmm. And I happen to serve on a committee. It's called the Technical Mapping Advisory Committee, and it helps advise FEMA on how the flood hazard mapping program should continue to evolve. And one of the recommendations that we've made is for FEMA to use more robust modeling and mapping technologies because we have them available to us, but that we look at more than just standard 10, 25, 50, 100, 500 year floods, but we look at a whole range of flood hazards using historic data, but also projecting future flood events as well.
So am I right that it sounds to me like it may be evolving from deductive to predictive?
Very much so. I think that's a very good statement. We're not there yet because, first off, we need to collect some additional data before we can project, future flood hazards. But one of the things that is occurring, and it's actually a byproduct of a bipartisan infrastructure law, is NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has been tasked to update all of the rainfall rates, the rainfall indices across the entire nation. And that's one of the main inputs when it comes to flood hazard mapping, is how much and how quickly the rainfall actually falls out of the sky, how that impacts conditions on the ground and can impact flooding. So it's hugely important that we continue to invest in data sets that help us inform not only historic flood hazards, but also to help us identify where future flood hazards are.
Last summer's flood has upended life in much of southeast Kentucky. The four most heavily impacted counties in particular, those are Breathitt, Knott, Letcher, and Perry. And you've heard that homes were destroyed or badly damaged, but those floodwaters also swept away important infrastructure, including scores of bridges, critical lifelines from homes on one side of a stream to the road on the other side. State Transportation Secretary Jim Gray.
We inspected 1,100 bridges. 1,100 bridges in less than 3 weeks. And out of that, as you said, we had 100 bridges that either need to be repaired or fully rebuilt. And we've already contracted for 40 of those bridges to be repaired and or rebuilt. Those projects represent, that 100 represents roughly what the cabinet would do in a year.
Will the design and engineering of replacement bridges anticipate future extreme weather?
When you have the conditions that we had with this flood, even the most structurally sound conditions that these bridges were designed to are going to be compromised. So we will do all we can to make improvements where we can. But what we're doing today is restoring the bridges that needed repairing those bridges, and we're building back new bridges. And where the new bridges can be built with some improvements, we're of course doing that as well.
State Transportation Secretary Jim Gray. Many nonprofit organizations have been working long hours since the morning of the flood. Apple Red's Whitney Bailey.
I try to be that one person they can come to, and I tell them, let me help shoulder these burdens for you. You've already got these paperwork requirements and boundaries you're dealing with on the FEMA appeal side, or you're still paying utility bills. What can we do to work with the utility companies to either stop that or, you know, put a pause on things? I'm doing what I can, but there's a lot of different hoops to jump through I didn't know existed.
Yeah.
Other key groups include Berea College's Brushy Fork Institute. On the day we visited a community listening session in the Knott County community of Emelina, the Institute's Donna Daniels was handing out a survey.
And what we're doing is we're collecting this information to really give us some hard data that we can use to talk to people about what are the needs that are still out there. So it's really helpful if we can get people to complete that survey for us.
It was one of four such gatherings organized in the region by the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, the foundation's Jerry Roll.
We have had person after person after person tell us nobody's ever asked us before. Why aren't we talking to the people most impacted about how we should be using these precious resources to get people what they really need? Otherwise, we're spending money hand over fist for things we don't even know if people want or need. So we have to ask them first and then spend the money. And my takeaway is people need places to live. And our job now is to be their advocate, to bring that money, to give people the power to choose their places to live, to be responsible, and to lift up and build the communities we want to live in and raise our family.
There's the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard, where Scott McReynolds is director. We wanted to know what help his group can provide.
Our programs combines relief funding with a mortgage. And so we are selling the houses to flood survivors. Hopefully the amount the family has to borrow is significantly less than it would be normally. So if a house appraises for 150, we'll sell it for 150. But that family may land up only with a loan of only 80 or 90 or maybe even a little less. A lot of it depends on how much FEMA money they got, whether they qualify for different pots of money that are available to different flood survivors.
And my question for Seth Long at Homes, Inc. in Whitesburg, do you all do the designs of these homes? Do you do the architecture and the engineering and all that?
We do. Most of the homes that we build, we design and get them approved through the funding sources that we use to be plans that are energy efficient and meet state building codes.
Have there been any changes in design to anticipate more extreme weather events like what happened in July?
Well, we don't build in the floodplain, so we've always anticipated that. We build them with an eye towards energy efficiency. A lot of times when families move into our homes, they can almost make the house payment with what they save on their energy bills. The other thing that we've been able to do, we are also a solar installer. So we'll install solar on commercial and residential projects, and we've been able to put solar energy on a few of our homes as well, which is pretty exciting.
Then there is FAHI, the Federation of Appalachian Housing Enterprises, which, just as its name implies, is a network of more than 50 nonprofits across Appalachia. Leadership, housing, education, health, social services, economic opportunity, all in one way or another, have been impacted by the recent flooding in the region. And since the most recent, the extreme flood of last July, what issues top your list of concerns and priorities right now?
I guess if we're talking about Eastern Kentucky in particular, mm-hmm. Right now, I'm probably focused more on two items. Housing certainly being one of those, as we know, the need for rebuilding is just enormous. A lot of people not in
in the best of housing conditions right now at a pretty bad time of year, given how the weather can change so quickly. The less obvious is around leadership. Our working theory is that programs are great, and all that list of, you know, education and health and social services. If you're trying to bring change in a community, though, it's local leaders that really do make a difference. Programs are great, ideas are great, but that local leader being supported, which is kind of back to our collaborative model, we support those leaders by helping them connect with others, and then we support them from our office with different kinds of financing, pass-through grants, you know, capital, and connecting them to experts in different fields.
And what about leadership? People with their own losses to try to manage while also pulling long hours absorbing the worries, the complaints, the pain and the exhaustion of their constituents, neighbors, friends, and families, and all that paperwork. Mary Cromer at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center.
I guess I will just say one of the things that has really struck us about the recovery effort, and also it relates to like all of the different funding streams that are being targeted at energy communities or disadvantaged communities, or, you know, what, however you parse it up, you know, Central Appalachian meets a lot of the criteria for additional funding from those different federal funding streams. So much of it depends on like strong local leadership asking for that money. And that's really hard when you're in the middle of like an ongoing flood recovery effort. You know, it's really hard to expect those local leaders to also be like checking in with, you know, various federal agencies on what different streams of money might be available, because so much of that depends on being that the local leaders are pushing for it. And that's just, you know, they're pretty busy right now.
Fahi's Jim King.
Not just the paperwork. I think, you know, it's the time and the planning and what's in the best long-term use of your community against some of these short-term issues, right? Like you mentioned, people in temporary housing, and if you have a limited amount of time and money, you know, fixing somebody's short-term problem right now may mean that you have to make a compromise on the long-term solutions.
For J.R. Sanderson with the Recovery and Resilience Organization, SPP, finding local officials stressed to the max following a natural catastrophe is not unusual.
Oftentimes after a major traumatic event, even our elected officials are flat-footed. They've never gone through this before. Most of them just need a good education here.
Many of the homes that were lost forever had been in families for many generations. But what got taken away by the flood of 22 was not just dwellings, as important as those are, but whole communities. Special Projects reporter Chris Begley is the grandson of Joe and Gaynell Begley, who owned the CB Cottle store in Blackie. That general store was a pillar of support for the surrounding community. Chris recalls and reflects.
I sat on the porch swing with my grandmother. She held up a letter from her sister. Her finger tapped the postmark. This is not where she lived. It was from the bigger town down the road. I don't know why this bothers me, she laughed, thinking she was being sentimental. I knew what she meant, though, and she was not bothered by the disappearance of a postmark. It was the erasing of a community. Sometimes communities are erased metaphorically. Sometimes it's a billion gallons of water. My grandfather also communicated the value of community in a different way. I was helping him out by pumping gas in the filling station they ran. Every time somebody came in and asked for a dollar of gas or paid with change, he would let the pump run until he'd put in twice that. If they had kids in the car, he'd run it up even more. At the other end of the building, in the general store, he'd put extra cans of soup or a loaf of bread in the bag if he thought somebody needed it. I asked him about that later, if it wasn't an expensive way to run a business. It'll cost you a lot more if you don't do anything, he said. What he meant, as I understood it, was that supporting the people who make up your community was important, because in the end, your fate is tied to the community. Sometimes it takes more than a can of soup or a gallon of gas to fix a community. Now, in times like this, it takes more. We're talking about creating new communities in eastern Kentucky, replacing the houses that have been lost, with some at an alternative location up out of the floodplain. Can we do that? Can you recreate something like that that's been lost? And what are the important things that you have to recreate? In Appalachia, the mountains divide people into small areas of flat land, but they also keep people together. Separated by the wooded hillsides and connected down at the main road at the mouth of the holler, these small pockets become a world apart. It's hard to imagine recreating that, but we're going to try. I suppose we have to try. We've been through these disasters before. We know about the Buffalo Creek disaster or Hurricane Katrina. We've seen what happens when people lose their connection to communities and how hard it is to get back. I spoke with Kai Erickson, a sociologist who studied the Buffalo Creek flood in West Virginia, where water from a broken dam at the head of a holler took over 100 lives and several hundred homes. Entire communities were damaged, and thousands of people were relocated. The loss of community created a second wave of trauma as bad as the actual disaster, he told me. I asked him what he'd learned, and if he had some insight into how communities can continue after such an event. He said he did have an insight, and an important one. He learned that when it comes to remaking themselves after a disaster, nobody knows better than the community members what tangible and intangible things need to be replaced and how. Communities are complex as the individuals that make them up, or maybe even more so, and it can take a lifetime to understand it all. As we rebuild, listening will be the most important thing we do.
Special Projects reporter, Chris Begley. Thanks for joining us. Rise, an Eastern Standard series, is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, G. Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Chris Begley, associate producer and special projects reporter, Corinne Boyer, WEKU special projects reporter, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, our contributors from WEKU News, Stan Ingold, Stu Johnson, and John McGarry, the Mountain Eagles, Sam Adams, Bill Eastep from the Herald Leader, Katie Myers with Appleshot WMMT, Anya Slepian and Joel Cohen from the Daily Yonder, and Breathitt County reporter Crystal Jones. Rise is online at weku-rise.org, and you can contact us from the site. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Rise, a production of Eastern Standard on WEKU.